Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. My name is Nigella Hilgarth and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium. And this is the latest in the Jeffrey B. Graham Lecture Series, Perspectives on Ocean Science. And it gives me very great pleasure this evening to introduce tonight's speaker, who is Dr. Jules Jaffe. And Dr. Jaffe is a research oceanographer here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the Marine Physical Lab. And he has a bachelor's degree in physics, he has a master's degree in biomedical information science, and a doctorate in biophysics from Berkeley. And then following graduation, he was a software engineer for quite some time, and then he joined the science staff at an institution we try not to mention too often in this room, Woods Hole, Oceanographic Institution, and there he saw the error of his ways, and he came to Scripps in 1988. And his research interests are broadly concerned with the use of new technology for observing ocean phenomena, and for the development of inverse techniques for their interpretation. And I'm not going to say any more because I think that's really what he's going to talk about tonight. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Jules Jaffe.
Thank you very much for coming tonight. Jeez, it's a huge crowd. I was trying to think of some bad puns to make. I won't go down with the ship, but it's really great to see you all here tonight. Of course, this is the week of the 100th anniversary of the Titanic, and I know a lot of people have probably come primarily to hear about my involvement with that, and I want to thank you for coming, and if you're not members of our aquarium, I'd like to ask you to think of joining, and for those of you that are members, I'd like to thank you for your continuing support. So let me start my story, underwater optical imaging from Titanic to the tiny. What I'd like to do is spend a bit of time, well, probably close to half the lecture, talking about my involvement in the finding of the Titanic, and then spend the other half of the lecture talking about what I did in the 25 years since then. So the name of the talk is Titanic to the Tiny. There's the Titanic, and there's the tiny. So I wanted to start by just telling you briefly about the things that we do in my lab. And the reason I love working here is because I can kind of do anything that I want within some general guidelines. One is I have to get it funded. Two is I have to write world-class articles about it. And three, I can't be mean to anybody else. Oh, no, that's not really one of the things. But I try to do all of those things. So here we see sort of the various activities in my group. Tonight we're going to talk about underwater optical imaging. We also do some vehicle development, and what I gave this talk 3 years ago, I talked about our new technology to build swarms of miniature robots, which I view as the next generation of underwater technology to explore the ocean. We have worked for many years in acoustic monitoring of marine systems. There is a pressing need to assay, understand, and conserve our ocean biota. And acoustics can play a major role in that. And, of course, we do education and outreach, which I'm very proud of. And all this kind of comes together in what I call science engineering. I'm sort of an engineist or a scienteer. I don't know if that sounds too much like a mouseketeer, but hopefully our science isn't very Mickey Mouse. So the one thing that kind of ties together, I like the people that are laughing. Thank you very much. They're friends of mine. The one thing that kind of ties together all of the things we do is we do it in situ. And so what that means in place, basically. So I'm sort of an empiricist. I like to observe things in their natural setting. And all the instruments that we build, really, with a few exceptions, but not many, are meant to observe things in the ocean, underwater. And so years ago, I thought, well, it would be really cool to get a license plate for my car. And they wouldn't give me in situ for some reason. And so this was the closest I get, of course, because wherever I am, I'm in situ, as you are as well right now with me. Chuckle, chuckle. Okay, it's going to get better, I promise. Okay. I mean, you have to have a good time. Otherwise, you know, there's something wrong. So what I thought we would highlight tonight is different scales in underwater imaging and how our research is really across these scales. And of course, one of my goals is to garner an appreciation on your part of some of the smallest things in the ocean and to highlight how important they are in our global ecology. And I would be remiss as a scientist if I was not, part of my mission was not to enlighten people about things that we find fascinating. So here we have size, 270 meters. That's the Titanic. It's about 3 football fields long. And here we go down the sort of scale. The giant whale is, a blue whale, which we have the wonderful pleasure of seeing offshore here, could be around 90 feet. There's a giant squid. Those are around maybe 70 or 80 feet. Of course, we know fish. Plankton, we're going to talk a bit more. These are sort of centimeters to millimeter-sized organisms. Phytoplankton are the plants, and we're going to talk a fair bit about microbes. And so what's interesting about this scale from the oceanographer's point of view is that there are lots more little guys than big guys. And when I say that, I don't mean just the number of little guys. I mean, if you added up all of their wet weight, you would find a huge, huge fraction of them are into the littlest organisms on the planet. But let's start with the Titanic. Okay, so as you very well know, the RMS Titanic departed Southampton for the first and only time on the 10th of April, tomorrow, 100 years ago, and sunk 4 days later on April 14th, 1912. And quite tragically, 1,600 people died in one of the biggest maritime tragedies of the century. There was an incredible amount of publicity on this ship. And over the years, I have tried to understand where that comes from. And now I'm not talking as a scientist. I'm just talking as a person who's sort of in awe of the unbelievable amount of focus that occurred on this still an awful tragedy. I think partly because it was a huge ship. The scale of this thing was, and so we were sort of challenging nature in a sense, and of course we were subject to its whims. The other part is the fact that there were 800 survivors, and there were so many stories that people told of the Titanic and the tragedy that were repeated and repeated and repeated. They actually became legends. And finally, I think there was this sense of equalization, that there were people in these incredibly fancy, luxurious salons, the Astors, the Strausses, who were the Macy's fortune, and many of them unfortunately perished, but also people in all of the steerages perished together. And I think there's a kind of message for us all there about what it means to be human. Now, what I wanted to make you into was a little bit of an ocean explorer, and explain how technology plays a role in the exploration of the ocean, and particular in the task of finding a wreck. And so what I thought I would do is use a much more contemporary example of a more recent tragedy that occurred, which we're all very familiar with. That is the disappearance of the Air France Flight 447, which left from South America and was lost somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean on its way to Paris. And I'm sure everyone in this room remembers how awful that was and this feeling of what happened to these people. And of course, many of us fly quite a bit, and it sort of sinks in when you think about, my God, it could have been me on that jetliner. So how did we find the black box for the Air France 447? You may recall that what we found was on the surface, there were some wings and some floating material, but what people really wanted was the black box, because that box had the information about what actually happened. And of course, we want to learn from these tragedies to ensure that they don't happen again. So let me tell you how we search for underwater wrecks. And this can apply to any underwater wreck, from a Roman shipwreck to a Polynesian shipwreck to anything. Basically, it turns out that sound travels pretty far in water compared to light. And this is why a lot of animals use sound to communicate. So, for example, if you have two blue whales and they're trying to make a date somewhere in the middle of the Pacific, one might be in England, the other might be, say, off the shore of New England in the United States, and they can communicate at extremely low frequencies. Fascinating enough, it takes about 20 minutes for the sound to travel across the ocean because it doesn't go as fast as light. But that kind of low-frequency sound isn't really good for finding stuff because the wavelengths are so long, we really can't get a good image. So we use higher-frequency sound. And so we invent a vehicle that can propagate sound out. One person who was very instrumental in this was Doc Edgerton, who I had the pleasure of meeting when I was at that other institution, which Nigella mentioned. And we send this sound wave out, and you guys don't have to really understand the detail. It's sort of an echo sounder. We bounce sound off the sea, and we record the intensity as a function of time. And by mapping this along, we can paint the sort of sonic picture of what's on the seafloor. But if you've ever looked at a sonogram and you've thought to yourself, my God, can't these guys get a better TV picture? You know, there are all these speckles on there. What's wrong with them? You know, there's billions of dollars in biomedical research. It turns out that inherent in the process of forming a sonic image is something called speckle. And that has to do with the fact that sound is almost like laser because it has a very, very coherent. It means all the waves kind of line up together. So when these folks went out to find this Air France wreck, because the black box was not located, even weeks and months and years later, they went out with a sonic mapping system. Here's a picture of the wreck. And you might look at this and say, my gosh, how the heck did they figure out that was a wreck? And the answer is, it wasn't certain to them that that was a wreck, but perhaps it was laying on a flat floor with not a lot of contrast. And they saw this kind of speckly thing there, which looked like it might have wings. And so the way you map things in the ocean is you go out with sound, because as I've told you already, it goes kind of far, maybe kilometers, half a mile. And then you look for what are called contacts. And when you go find these contacts, then you go back with an optical imaging system, because the optical imaging system uses what we all know and love, and most of us know and love to do, is to be able to see. It turns out the major part of your neocortex is dedicated to seeing. And so that must have been a huge evolutionary advantage for people to be able to see. And so we go back with optics. And here we see a picture of one of the, this was actually, I think, one of the motors that was on that wreck. Okay, so you're saying to me, okay, Jaffe, what does this have to do with the Titanic? Well, that's what I'm going to tell you next. So the Titanic, as you know, was lost, and pretty much nobody knew exactly where it was, even Ballard. Although I have an iota of doubt in that, but nevertheless, because he was actually very lucky, so we think. And it left Southampton, and as we know, there were several sightings, and the Carpathia came to rescue people, and they had pretty good idea of the locus of the Titanic. But nobody really knew exactly where it was. Now with GPS and all these crazy things, we can get, you know, meter scale accuracy. So Ballard had this idea to go find it. And so like everyone else who does underwater search, he said, well, first what I'm going to do is I'm going to get a sonar and I'm going to go take it out there or get somebody else to take it out there. And they're going to identify these contacts. And then I'm going to go check the contacts out with my new optical imaging system, which we'll see in a minute. Oh, then I go to Woods Hole. So how do I weave myself into this picture? So this is me back then. You can see my hair was a slightly different color. And this is Ballard back then wearing his traditional cap. And so here I am, this sort of transplanted New Yorker, gone to Atlanta, gone to the Bay Area, gone to Woods Hole, where I might add the restaurants were awful. And you know, I meet this guy, and he's very dynamic and exciting, and I realize very quickly that he wants to be the most famous ocean explorer ever. And I'm like, wow, that's interesting. I'd never thought of doing that myself. Mostly I was interested in Chinese food. So here he is, and so he says to me, you know, I want to find the Titanic. And what am I thinking? Yeah, right, sure. Well, I was wrong, okay. Nevertheless, let's talk about the physics of light propagation in the ocean. Okay, so Ballard said to me, look, I'm going to build this optical imaging system called Argo, And I've been using optical imaging systems. So Ballard had a lot of experience going in the submersible Alvin, which you may know is the deep submersible that the Woods Hole Oceanographic built. Turns out they had built three titanium hulls, and one of them was reserved for scientists. It was really a sort of a bathyscaphe of sorts. And his comment, he was quite well known at this time for finding and exploring these deep hydrothermal vents, which really revolutionized our thinking about biology, because previous to this, everyone thought, my goodness, we have to have photosynthesis in order for life to exist on Earth. And we go down to these thermal vents where there's no light, and all of a sudden there's all these creatures living down there. So how are they living? It turns out they're using different mechanisms. So Ballard said to me, look, you know, it's a long elevator ride down there on Alvin, and then I only get a couple hours down, and then I've got to come all the way up. So what I want to do is have a system that uses light and can take pictures. So we invented something called Angus. Angus was a sled that was deeply towed with 35-millimeter cameras. But Angus sort of suffered from the same thing. When you towed Angus down, you had to take all these pictures, and it had no real-time connection to the ship. And then you got it back, and you developed the pictures, and you saw where you were, but you couldn't see them in real time. So Ballard thought, well, you know, the next step would be to have a video sled down, and he named it the Argo. And he brought me in, and I had been working in Silicon Valley, as Nigella said. And he said, look, I want you to be my physics guy, because my degree is in biophysics and physics. And I want you to be my imaging guru. And I said, okay, I'm, you know, fine. And he said, I want you to teach us how to build an underwater imaging system from the point of view of how do we get the best results. I mean, people know how to wire cameras. I'm not a camera wire. I have wonderful engineers in my groups. But think about this. When you're driving in a fog bank, what's your first impulse? To turn on your brights, right? And what happens when you turn on your brights? Well, you don't see very far. And so when you're in the ocean, you're in a very foggy world. And we as terrestrial creatures don't really quite understand all the limits of our ability to see underwater. But people who studied this knew about it. And so Ballard said, okay, figure it out. Tell us how to design this video, optical, deeply towed system so we can get really cool pictures, or we can do the best we can. This is the concept of optimization. You can't do everything. I said, okay, all I have to learn is all these equations. And, you know, I took E&M and I actually did pretty well in electricity and magnetism, and it's going to take me on, maybe in a couple of years I'll have the answer. And he looks at me like, Jules, I have a better idea. I said, what? He said, go to Scripps. Because in Scripps, there was a group called the Visibility Lab. And they were disbanded right after I had gotten here, somewhere in the mid-80s. But they were really the world's experts in underwater imaging. And I did want to mention in this lecture that one of the most amazing explorers was a colleague of mine, Fred Spies, who passed away a number of years ago. And one time, I was sitting around with Ballard, as we did, and I said, Bob, who else in the world could do the kind of deep sea exploration as you? And he said, Jules, there is one person, and it's Fred Spies. And so that was pretty amazing. And Spies had actually gone out. You may recall the Texas millionaire Grimm had funded Spies to go out with the deep system that they had in their lab, and unfortunately didn't find it. But Ballard said, okay, go thee to the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and talk to these guys, and they had pretty much figured it out. So what we did was we basically took their work, which is what progress is, right? I mean, we build on the work of other people, and we made a computer program, and we actually, since I was a computer science-y kind of guy and a physicist, I could figure out how to make a computer program to actually simulate the underwater propagation of light and use this as sort of a design device, like where do we put the lights, what do the pictures look like, that kind of thing. And so here are some of the results. This is a checkerboard pattern. And as we get further and further away, here's our fog. We don't want to turn on our fog lights. And here's the same checkerboard pattern, but now this is in a coastal region. So in the coastal region, it turns out the blue-green light goes through much more easily than the blue light. So we did these simulations, and we were able to quantify this. And so when his group actually did complete the Argo vehicle, which they did, I had played an important role, and I think the engineers that were there at the time would agree, in helping them understand how to configure this vehicle so that the camera and lights were appropriately incorporated to optimize. Remember the word optimize. Doesn't mean we're going to see something from 3 miles away. We're just going to do the best we can. And so we optimized the Argo vehicle for underwater imaging. So back to the Titanic story now. Ballard said to himself, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go find it with sound, like everyone else does. And he had very close colleagues in France. There's a wonderful organization there called IFREMIR, and the French have certainly wonderful technology. And he said, you know, you guys have this wonderful sonar, and we'll form a partnership, and we can discover the Titanic together. And that was the nice thing about working with Ballard. He really was good at forming these partnerships, collaborative partnership. So the French go out with this beautiful sonar. It's a rather large torpedo-shaped thing. And now just remember that little graph that I showed you. The sound gets transmitted out, and then it bounces off the seafloor, and it's reflected. And then hopefully you find some targets that look like the Titanic, because maybe you can see a half a mile. And what you want to do is you want to map, we call it mowing the lawn. What you want to do is you want to map a pattern and then just methodically go back and forth to find contacts that are potentially the Titanic. Okay, and then the next thing you want to do is go back with the Argo vehicle, now with this wonderful telemetry system, which allows you to sit in the ship in this containerized freight and get very seasick looking at a screen. I mean, one of the worst experiences at sea, and I can tell you firsthand, is looking at a TV screen while you're on a rocking boat. Nevertheless, you see what this is seeing, and he has this whole idea of telepresence, which is a brilliantly conceived idea. And the idea is you don't have to be there. You can have your eyes and ears and maybe even your hands down there, but you're sitting on the ship, you can get a lot of time mapping it. Well, this all sounded great, except there was one problem. They didn't find any contacts. So 3 weeks later, Ballard had scheduled to go out and look for the Titanic. And his plan was to use the optical imaging system. And I've already told you, light doesn't go very far in the ocean. So Bob did what any, you know, red-blooded person would do. He just went out there and tried to do the best job that he could. And fortunately, or luckily, he actually found it. They ran over one of the boilers. And his insight, and I believe this is true, is that the reality was that you didn't really have to run over the ship. We've already talked about the fact that the ship is 3 football fields long. And if your light can only see maybe a quarter of a football field away, my gosh, you're going to have a hard time. You're going to mow that lawn with an edge trimmer, you know. You're going to get like a little teeny swath that you can mow with. And Ballard realized that when these things break up, they actually create a debris field. And so you didn't really need to run over the ship. What you needed to run over was some of the debris from that ship. And it turned out in the case of the Titanic, the debris field was about, you know, on the order of a mile and a half long. So his transects were spaced appropriately. He didn't have to go a quarter of a football field. He could go like every other football field. And they did, in fact, run over one of the boilers. Now, I didn't go on this. And in principle, I don't regret it. Bob made it, he had this sort of lab theme. Everybody had to get dressed up in these like blue unisuits, you know, with a little deep submergence. And I don't look good in a onesie, I can tell you. So I just decided I'll stay home. And I did go on the next expedition, which was to the East Pacific Rise. And to me, the science, I mean, I'm not saying we only need to do science, but I was not interested in finding the Titanic. I was interested in the technology, and I was interested in transferring that technology to science. But I actually had more fun, because instead of sitting on a ship in a containerized freight car getting sick looking at a video, I was in Woods Hole. And I kept getting these, they stuck me in the public relations office, and we got calls from ABC, NBC, CBS, Le Monde, the London Observer. And I was really one of the few people who knew what the technology was. So I really had a lot of fun with this, as I'm having now, telling you the story, even though I wasn't out on there. And so here's a picture of a boiler. That's about 20 feet. I mean, the scale of this thing was absolutely, absolutely monstrous. So now you can actually, you know, fast forwarding to 2012, You can actually pay $60,000, which I can't do in my head, is some number of rubles, to go take one of these Mir submersibles down to the Titanic, and you can sit yourself on the deck. And so it's a well-established fact where the Titanic is. And I saw Ballard the other night on TV, and basically he was, I agreed with what he was saying, that, you know, these things are landing on the deck, and it's really a historical monument that we should conserve. And that's certainly true of any historical monument, and I think that they should try to conserve it however they can. But there's one sort of enigma about this that I wanted to tell you. Now, admittedly, I was sort of, you know, stranger in a strange land. But here's Ballard going to Washington, and he's getting a lot of money to do this stuff. And I thought, my gosh, I mean, is the Navy that interested in finding the Titanic that they're going to literally give Ballard all of this money? And unbeknownst to me at the time, and I only found this out 5 years ago, as you might have as well, there was a backstory to the search for the Titanic. And that was that Ballard had been commissioned by the Navy. He actually proposed to the Navy that he would create an underwater imaging system to survey the wrecks of two nuclear submarines. Here's the Scorpion and the Thresher. These were huge tragedies that occurred. As a San Diego resident, most of us are aware we have the fast attack fleet here. We're very proud of those ships. You see them coming in and out of the bay. They're wonderful, wonderful machines that hopefully keep us safe. And in the 60s, both of these ships were lost, and it was a huge tragedy. Here's the Scorpion, 1968, 99 people were aboard. Here's the Thresher, 1963, 129 people were aboard. And these were both nuclear subs, I might add. And so one of the scary things about these is that the Scorpion actually had two nuclear-tipped torpedoes on it. And I'm not sure about Thresher, and I don't even want to know about Thresher. But Ballard had the top secret clearance from the Navy, and I wasn't cleared into that program at that time, to go survey these ships. Now, the Trieste, you may be familiar. Cameron was just down in the Marianas Trench, being the third person ever to visit it. The Trieste was down there, and they had a long ride for not a lot of time. Trieste had surveyed at least Scorpion, and I'm not sure about Thresher. So the Navy knew exactly where they were, but the survey was not well appreciated. I don't know what the quality of the images were. But the backstory was Ballard had talked to the Admiral and said, hey, I can go survey these wrecks, but what I want in exchange, other than the money to build these systems, is to be able to use it. And if you look where these are on a map, they're not that far away from the Titanic, basically. And I want to go find the Titanic. So my conclusion was that Ballard's Deep Submergence Lab, of which one I was a member, in fact, he had tasked me with being the leader of his image processing group, was commissioned by the Navy to develop an economical and systematic way of surveying the deep ocean. And this was, I think, a kind of statement that was made with the Titanic at the time, that the deep ocean now can be surveyed, because before people thought it was just a dumping ground. And there's lots of stuff there, I can assure you. And so the backstory was that Ballard had figured out a way to get this very cleverly, and he's very patriotic, and he was a lieutenant, I believe, in the Navy as well, and I think he was very much in league with helping these figure out what the current state, that was in 1985, of these two wrecks were. So, what about today in my lab? Well, via the work that I did with Ballard and the ensuing years, we were able to continue our work in underwater optical imaging by building a next generation and a next generation of underwater optical imaging systems. And since I had gone to Woods Hole and Ballard was actually a geologist, I had become interested in underwater mapping of the seafloor. So we actually built this system here. This is a video that I did. This is actually a three-dimensional system. So instead of just taking pictures, we could actually take a picture, almost like a stereo picture, and we could judge the shape of things, three-dimensional shape. And the theory was that if you had a thing like this mantamine, this thing is about this big around, and it costs around $50,000. And it's the Navy regards this as asymmetric warfare because it can blow, you know, $50 million worth of damage in a ship. And these are scary things. So we built a three-dimensional imaging system to actually get three-dimensional images of these manta mines, among other things. And I have to be honest with you, this is a scan that we did in air. And in the water, we actually got pretty good pictures, but nothing. You can actually see the shackle here. So what you're looking at now is there's no color. It's a monochrome system. It's a three-dimensional rendering of the three-dimensional map, which gave us both height and also reflectivity of a three-dimensional object. And so that was a fun thing. And then today, and so you might notice this little logo here from our friends across the continent, we are building what I hope will be the best underwater optical imaging system in the world under some very, very, very nice Navy funding. And the newest generation of underwater systems will not be tethered. They will be autonomous. And here you can see a torpedo-like object called an autonomous underwater vehicle, or AUV. And what this illustration shows exactly what I was telling you. First, we're going to map it with sound, okay? And we're not doing the sonar, but here's what we're doing. It's an optical imaging system here being flown on this REMUS 600 vehicle, which will go back and check out these targets. As I told you, the sonogram will tell you where the interesting places are to look, and then you will go back with this autonomous torpedo and you will investigate the contacts. So we're having a lot of fun about that. With that, we've got a nice program. But now let's get back to a little more of the other things that I do in my group. And we're, believe it or not, we're going to talk about each one of these things, and I'll try to do it quickly, but the light is a little better now. So let's talk about the denizens of the deep. So we're terrestrial organisms. We live on land. But there are experts in underwater optical imaging. It just happens they're not people. They're animals. And so here's one of them. Oh, so this is a program that we have funded through the Navy. This is a really nice multiple university research investigatorship with a bunch of people from Scripps, Duke, and UCSB. And this is a cephalopod here, a squid. And so these animals can live all through some of the fairly deep parts of the ocean. They don't get down in the Marianas Trench. And this program is to understand their reflectivity, okay, with the idea that the Navy is thinking about maybe a future system, like a seal. Instead of wearing a wetsuit, they could wear a wetsuit that actually had the ability to change its color via active camouflage. Or a submarine, you could coat it. And so it's sort of like taking a TV and wrapping it around a three-dimensional object and having the ability to have anything on that TV that you want within the confines of the display technology. And the Navy said, look, this is so cool. We're going to fund a bunch of people at universities to go figure this stuff out. And I love the fact that there is a strong spirit in this country of research and innovation. And some of that is based on fundamental knowledge. And so the world's experts in doing this are these cephalopods, octopus, squids, and cuttlefish. And so they've evolved some really incredible technology to do this. And here's one, okay? Now, this is really a creepy slide. But, you know, this is an eye, okay? And this is an eye of a giant squid. And this eye is about the size of a soccer ball, right? And you're thinking, geez, that's huge. And these animals have evolved this huge eye to see in the deep ocean. And they're actually seeing in places where the sunlight does not penetrate. So, you guys thought you were going to wait to the end to talk to ask me a question. Well, I'm going to wait to ask you a question. If this animal developed this eye to see in the deep ocean, and there's no sunlight down there, what is it seeing? And don't answer me now. We're going to see. We have some young people here. I want to see if they can figure this out. Okay? So this was caught off Hawaii, and the pupil of this eye is 3.5 inches, so it's this big, basically. Now, here's a master of camouflage. This is actually a cuttlefish. And here you can see the eye of the cuttlefish, and it's sitting in this sort of area with a bunch of algae. And it's disguised itself. These are kind of unprotected animals. They don't have very many natural defenses. They're vulnerable. So it figured out a way to change its skin color and its texture and its even reflectivity to be able to look inconspicuous. As you know, you've seen chameleons, and some of you might be familiar with these things. And it can sense its environment and modulate its color so that it can change its actual reflectivity and color. So we put together a team a number of years ago, and we've built a number of instruments to study these animals. One of them is an omnidirectional camera for recording light fields in the ocean. Another one is what I call the squid holodeck. So I'm sort of a former Trekkie, you know, and if you remember the Star Trek, they would go to the holodeck. So we built a virtual visual environment for squid and octopus and cephalopods and put them in there and see how they react to do the science of what are the possible numbers of displays that they can garner. And then a student of mine is working on a reflectance meter to quantitatively characterize the reflectivity of these sea creatures under various conditions. So I'll just take a little while to show you a few things. So this is a sphere, as I've said, 17-inch diameter. It has 6 HDTVs in it, all battery-powered, all on a wireless with 7 computers. And it takes pictures. So think about, I'm looking forward, I'm looking backwards, I'm looking to the right, I'm looking to the left, I'm looking up, I'm looking down. And this is all battery-powered. It actually has a 6,000-meter depth rating on it. And so here we are in the kelp forest, looking at the light from all these different directions, quantitatively characterizing the fluctuations in that light field. Here's an octopus sitting in the squid holodeck. And what I want to draw your attention to is this sphere here. We're going to show a display of what this animal is seeing. You can see it's a nice little orange color now, kind of doing what octopuses do, looking for a place to cuddle into and get away from this awful environment. Oh, there's a barracuda. Look what happened to the octopus. It turned black. And it turned black within one frame of our camera, which is at most a 30th of a second. Oh, here's the barracuda again. You can fool me once, but you can't fool me twice. These are really smart animals. And lastly, I want to show this reflectance meter. It's a little complicated, but basically I just want to characterize the fact that we're building this instrument. And using this instrument, my student Justin Hogg has been actually to look at the reflectivity. Now, it turns out a really good strategy for hiding in the ocean is to be a mirror. Because if you're thinking about it, if the ocean is fairly clear, sunlight's coming from all directions, I can hold a mirror up in front of me, and the reflectivity from that mirror kind of looks like what's behind me. So these animals that are silvered are actually very good at hiding in this light environment. And here you see an incident light beam in blue, and it reflects pretty much like a mirror. That little orangey-yellow one is the mirror. And here we see now a Humboldt squid, these crazy animals that are offshore here. This time it's red. This is not the natural color of a Humboldt squid. This is what happens when you actually kill them and take their skin off, but they actually they have these things called chromophores. So this is a color that this squid can actually become. And here you see a bit more of a diffuse reflectivity pattern. So now let's move down the tree here, going from our Titanic to our microbes. And I'm going to check my time. And so we're going to talk now about zooplankton. And these are animals that are sort of millimeter to centimeter in size. And so here's a herbivorous zooplankton, vegan, we might say. And these are really cool. They have these antennae, and these are kind of like the hair cells that are in your cochlea that sense sound, and we think they use them for mechanoreceptors. And then this is courtesy of my close friend and colleague, Peter Franks. And so there you have other kind of zooplankton. Here's a carnivorous zooplankton eating this poor little copepod. And this is called a ketognath. So this guy is really awesome. It's about an inch in length, right? And if you do a scanning electron micrograph of this, this is what its head looks like. So it's crazy. It's got these four fangs with tetrodotoxin that it can inject into its prey. I mean, these guys don't fool around, you know? You got to eat, right? And then, of course, there are the zooplankton that are, so that's a carnivorous zooplankton. Of course, fish eat zooplankton. So zooplankton are really important. They're not just important, they're actually really cool And so there's lots of different kinds in the ocean. And so we've actually built an imaging system, and my student Christian Briceno is here tonight, who has been working wonderfully with us. He's our resident biologist, taking pictures of all of these zooplankton. So when you look at these, you see these sort of annoying dark bands. Try to filter those out and think about the fact that you're seeing this ketognath, this 1 centimeter, this one's a bit smaller than an inch, jellies, copepods. And so what I find really fascinating is to think about what the world looks like from their point of view. And when I showed this slide to some scientists at USC, I received a wonderful compliment from a very prominent researcher there. And he said, you know, Jules, years ago when we first started to explore the ocean, we dove and we took pictures. And then as time has evolved, we've become less observational and we've become more doing, you know, just things like scooping stuff up and doing genomics, which has led to marvelous insights into the ocean. But he says, what's really cool about what you're doing is you're actually taking pictures again, but now at this microscopic scale. And you see all these little filaments. These are actually filamentous diatoms. Think of this little tube guy swimming around in a world with all these little filaments around it. And it's really fascinating to me to think about these organisms. And these views, I might add, when I show them to people that look at zooplankton professionally in the lab, and they say, look, these are amazing images. What lab system did you use? I said, no, it's actually an in situ, remember the car. And this one's for 500 meters. And the best compliments I ever get are from people who do this for a living. And they said, these are the best images we've ever seen. And they're just about as good as the ones that we've been getting in the lab. So that was really exciting to us. So we actually went out a couple of weeks to do a cross-calibration and look at our acoustics and our optics. I don't have time to tell much of that story. But just to let you know, we go out. We were offshore here a couple of miles. And we got this really cool picture. And what we're seeing here now is 3 different kinds of organisms. So this is a millimeter, you know, like a 25th of an inch. And what you're seeing is a little jelly here, and it's caught. One of these little copepods is in its little tentacles. So this guy is sort of toast, as we would say. And these things are actually giant diatom, the plants. So I really, you know, I'm kind of geeky. So I kind of like this idea that we have 3 different taxa here, copepod, jelly, diatoms. And this marvelous instrument, it's not a great image, but we're hoping to get even better images with the next generation of underwater imaging systems. So let's go to the phytoplankton. So years ago, Peter Franks and I went out to sea, and we did sort of what Ballard did. We stuck a camera in the water, and we had some sound we were sending out, and we got these really smeary images. And it occurred on us, to us, occurred to us that we have to be in the coordinate system of the animals themselves, not on a bouncing ship with cameras going up and down. So we built this thing, which is an autonomous profiler, which has cameras on it, has a laser sheet. And basically, here's the artist's concept, where it slowly descends through the water. This is actually a sheet of light, and there's a camera here that I don't show, taking pictures of now the phytoplankton, the next thing down in that scale. These are the plants that generate a huge amount of oxygen, and they're also eaten by the herbivorous zooplankton. And so we were out one time, and this was another sort of exciting moment for us. You know, it's not a Jackson Pollock painting. These are actually little strands of diatoms. And when we started showing these around, people said to us, my gosh, what's really interesting to us, we've only ever viewed these in the lab, and what you're seeing, these strands are actually longer than any strands we ever saw in the lab. And it was kind of like the bell went off, ding, 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 ding. Could it be that when we actually bring these things back from the sea, that even the mild amount of mixing and turbulence that we actually create, breaking these things up? And so now you start thinking of the ocean as a place where there's maybe these sort of more fragile interactions between organisms that we don't know of. And a very wonderful colleague of mine, Farouk Azam, here. Of course, one of the great things about sitting on this hill is you've got some of the best people in the world to go have lunch with, and they're very friendly. And so Farouk, and there's good Chinese food in town. But Farouk was, had this whole idea about marine snow and how gooey the water might be. And so when we bring things up in the lab, so again, we need to be doing these things in situ, and here it is. This is a pseudonychia. It's a chain-forming diatom, and these things reproduce and form these long, 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 long chains. And it was interesting. I was actually on a sabbatical in Spain, and I showed a person at the next desk one of these pictures, and she was in charge of the marine collection programs. They worry about these harmful algal blooms. And she said, my gosh, I'd never seen them that long either. So that's the kind of stuff that I love. And here we are. We actually went out this past August redoing our experiment. This time we had the sonar on here. And, of course, one of the great things about oceanography is the amount of teamwork it takes. And I'm not talking just about the science and students. It's the people that man the ships and make us all possible, because they have to have a lot of patience, I must tell you. So let's now talk about the microbes in the last little bit of time. And I wanted to sort of emphasize the importance of microbes in the ocean. So I thought, well, you know, we are a host, right? I mean, you're a host to, well, some are better hosts. No, we're not going to talk about that. But some are better hosts than others in the sense that, you know, there are all these gut flora that you basically have a relationship with. And when it works, it's great. And when it doesn't, it can be awful. So what about people? Okay. Well, I looked it up. The average male is 175 pounds. And you're, you know, sort of got about 2 pounds of microbes in you. So whether you believe it or not, you're a walking Petri dish. But the reality, of course, is that you're a lot more. There's a lot more of you than them. Okay. Well, what about the ocean? Okay. Whoa, here's the microbe, and here's a blue whale, okay? So, if you look at the dry weight of the mass of blue whale, and you compare that with all the microbes, you've got basically a million time weight. We're not just counting individuals. If you actually weighed these things, here's all the blue whales in the ocean. Here's all the microbes in the ocean. So these guys are important. And this is a fascinating one that was discovered here at Scripps by Brian Palahniuk. This is the smallest known eukaryote cell. So, what don't we know about these? Well, we sort of think that it's all worked out. And when you take classes in school, you sort of think it's all worked out because that's what they're showing you. But then you find out that it's really not all worked at all, because the reality, this is what people might think the ocean looks like. Notice this is a micron, twice the wavelength of light. And this is 100 microns, the thickness of a human hair. And so these are all different kinds of crazy creatures that are these size. But the reality is something like this. My God, we don't know whom is eating whom or what's going on with what. And so this is a whole world of discovery and exploration that we really, really don't understand. And so to me, the exciting thing, I mean, when I was a student, they said, we have to learn all this stuff. So I sort of learned it, and I was pretty good at it. But then you get to the last chapter, and they look at you and say, okay, now we don't know something that we'd like to know, and you can write the next chapter. And that's when I got excited. So what about underwater 3D microscopy? We might want to build a three-dimensional microscope instead of just taking pictures. And what might the features of that microscope be? Well, the wish list is high resolution, non-invasive, large depth of focus. We want to survey a large volume. And we'd like to have fast movies, because if things are jiggling around at fast speeds, we want to do high-speed movies of them. And so we actually proposed, and were successful, to get something like this funded from the Keck Foundation. And you might know the Keck Foundation. They do infrastructure, so we have a Keck lab at Scripps. You may have visited the telescope on Mauna Kea, which has been funded by Keck. And the wonderful thing about Keck is they say, look, we don't want stuff that, you know, the National Science Foundation is going to fund. We're happy with NSF money. Don't take any away. But we want to know, like, a decade. Like, think about what you can't do today and what might you want to do in a decade. So I thought, well, this is the kind of world I like to live in. And so we came up with this crazy idea to build an underwater three-dimensional microscope which would allow video rate behavioral observations. And so we're going to do behavioral observations. And we actually got it funded. They gave us $1 million in January. And I said, thank you so much for the opportunity, and we're going to make the most of it. So we flow the water down this channel. We close off the two ends. We have four very, very high-speed cameras, some lasers and lights, and we take pictures inside of this three-dimensional volume. Here we're showing a kind of, you know, the way your eye works, you have a fovea, which has high resolution and lower resolution around the outside. So it's kind of a nested imaging system. So we had the idea, well, let's build a 1 centimeter cube with some resolution, maybe, you know, a thousandth of that. And then let's build a 1 millimeter cube inside of that, which could have maybe a 200th or a 500th of that. So the concept here is that we can actually identify things when they swim through this little volume and then track them in 3D once we know what they are. So we haven't even started this yet, but we're obviously very, very excited about it. And so I wanted to conclude my talk now. We've gone from the Titanic to the Tiny. We've talked about finding ships, about you're now all experts in searching the deep ocean for wrecks. And I've desperately tried to make you think that the smallest things in the ocean are really the most fun. And this is the best image we ever got here. This is actually taken by a colleague of ours in the Gulf of Aqaba. That's a little bit south of the southernmost point of Israel. And this is a tenophore. People say, oh, it looks like an eyeball. And that's true. But this is, you know, a little over an inch and a half across. And what this is, it's a comb jelly. And here you see that it's on a fishing expedition. And it's fishing for little animals that are in the water that it hopes get stuck in these filaments. And if you didn't have an imaging system and you used only a net, you would never see the incredible beauty of this mesh that this animal exudes in order to satisfy its hunger. So it's and also it was kind of cool that it's an undescribed species. So you've now seen an undescribed species. So that's pretty much it. I want to thank you much for your attention, and I hope you've all enjoyed the talk tonight. Thank you very, very much. So the question was the Mary Rose, which is a historical wreck. Is it in the Thames River, the Mary Rose, I think?
Yes.
Somewhere off the coast of England. We actually had a wonderful lecture a week and a half ago. We're thinking of starting an underwater archaeology group here, and we're pretty excited about that. So why is the Mary Rose, which is 500 years old, intact enough to be able to bring it up, and the Titanic, which is only 100 years old, isn't? And I think the answer lies in the fact that the Mary Rose sunk into the mud. And as a ship that was made out of wood, there are little critters that live in the mud or not live in the mud. And in this case, we call anoxic. There's a lack of oxygen in the mud. So the Mary Rose was fortunate enough to be covered by the seafloor mud or sediment, as we say, early enough in its evolution. And so there's a lot of interesting wooden shipwrecks. When I was in Spain, they showed me a picture of a Greek shipwreck that had been in the deep sediment. Now, think about the Titanic. It's a metal. It's sitting in a very corrosive environment. And Ballard had described rather poetically these rusticles. So it's a wonderful question. It has to do with the corrosive capability of the ocean and the anoxic environment that some of these ancient wrecks find themselves in when they are buried in sediment. You're welcome. Question? Oh, the answer to the question. Okay, so why does a squid have such a giant eye if there's no natural light down that far? Does anybody know the answer to that question? I'll award you a graduate student research assistantship. Christian, what's the answer? It's bioluminescence. Yeah. It turns out that 90% of the creatures that live in the deepest parts of the ocean have something called bioluminescence. And you guys are probably familiar with the red tides we get offshore. When they actually have a mechanical deformation, they emit a light. And there are various hypotheses on why animals or organisms like these red tides, they're actually a plant, do that in the surface waters. But in the deeper part of the ocean, we think that they may use that as a way of communicating, as a way of lighting up their enemies. So the speculation was that, say, a whale, like a sperm whale, which a giant squid would love to get its hands on, or tentacles, I should say, swimming through the water in the deep ocean, would probably light up all this bioluminescence, and having a giant eye allows you to have a lot more light collection efficiency. It's a not simple thing to understand unless you're really kind of into cameras, but you may be familiar with the F number of your camera and how much light it can collect. And the bigger the lens, the more light it can collect. So it turns out that that squid is probably just hanging out, waiting for some giant critter to run by, lighting up all the little things in the ocean that bioluminesce. And thank you for reminding me. So this gentleman wants to know why the Titanic broke in two pieces. And I think I know why. And it turns out that, as you may recall, somewhat dramatically, I might add, from the movie, the ship actually sunk the bow down into the water first, right? And although the depiction in the movie is probably a bit over what happened, people actually think that the Titanic might have tilted forward by about 11 degrees. And now when you make a ship, it's not actually constructed in a way that allows it to be able to be... So what happens? The nose is in the water, and the back of it's kind of not really in the water, but you have all the weight of that metal pushing down. And so it's almost like a tube that doesn't have a lot of stability if you wanted to bend it. Do you know what I mean? Almost like a straw that's really stiff, but if you push too hard, it snaps in two. So the speculation actually is that when the bow sank, the stern pushed down on it and flexed the hull so that it broke into two pieces. So thank you for asking that question. Right, so the question was, what was the actual area that Ballard was looking for the Titanic in, and how long did it take him to find it? Well, it's not actually clear to me how long it took him to find it, because I had heard several stories. I mean, I knew they left shore on a certain date, and then they said, oh, well, we found it after 3 days, and I was kind of thinking, like, what did they do with the other 7 days, basically? So it turned out we now know he was surveying one of those ships. I don't think he surveyed both of those. I think you go on a probability analysis type of thing. He actually asked me to look up the RAND Corporation. They had all these crazy search algorithms to optimize search. And if you're interested in that technology, there's a company called Metron that actually did a lot of math for the search for the Air France ship. But I would imagine that he just started searching in the most probable area and tried to work his way. The French actually had run over it with their sonar. Well, not run over it, but they had seen it with their sonar. But it was in the first day or two, and they thought, well, the contact isn't really look like it's a ship, but we don't know, but we don't think it's Titanic. So they went on. So actually, I think people had a pretty good idea of the area it was. But I don't know the detailed answer to your question. Like, was he looking in 5 square miles or 20 square miles? And I can't really answer you with any authority.
Okay, well, please join me in thanking Dr. Jill.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.